This is the Blacklist Podcast, and as always, I'm your host, Franklin Leonard, founder and CEO of the Blacklist, joined, as always, by...
Kate Hagen, Director of Community at the Blacklist.
And so we have the second of two interviews with ESPN documentarians for you this week. Last week was Jason Hare, who did The Last Dance. This week, we have Director of Be Water, Bao Nguyen. Kate, this was a fun one.
Yeah, it was really great to get to talk to Bao after we talked to Jason about what it's like to sort of live in the ESPN documentary space, but we talk about much more than Be Water, which is fantastic. It's every bit as good as The Last Dance. If you haven't had a chance to see it yet, you absolutely have to. But we're going to talk to Bao about more than just that. We're going to talk about his documentary on Saturday Night Live. We're going to talk about depictions of the Vietnam War on film and much more. It's a really excellent conversation with Bao.
Bao is amazing. His most recent work is a documentary about Bruce Lee. If that doesn't sell you, I don't know what will. Here it goes. Me and Kate and Bao.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
So, Bao, we love to open every conversation by asking all of our guests the same question, which is, can you remember the first movie you ever saw in a movie theater? And please set the scene for us.
The first movie I ever saw that I remember ever seeing in the movie theater is Terminator 2 Judgment Day, when I was the ripe old age of 9. It was like the midnight showing. I was in Tampa Bay visiting my cousins, and I just pretty much followed along whatever they wanted to do.
So this is like older cousins, and you're all like, we're going to Terminator 2 at midnight, and at 9, yeah, you're like, yes, we are.
I'm like, sure, I have no idea what this movie is about. I wanted to see, like, I mean, I don't think Home Alone was out at the time, but I'm in that type of vibe, I guess. Right. And so I go, and it's so violent, that film, obviously. And I remember I was so tired because I was 9. I was like visiting for my spring break, and I fell asleep during Terminator 2. And now it's kind of a running gag that I fall asleep in a lot of movies, even if I love the movies. And maybe I can just trace it back to childhood trauma and just say, well, I fell asleep watching Terminator 2, like a really kind of in-your-face film. So don't be mad if I fall asleep at your art house film. It's not a judgment on your film in any way.
Right, no, it's totally just a me thing. It's what I do.
Yeah. And I remember waking up at moments where people's heads, T-1000's heads being blown up and then being put back together and, you know, motorcycle chases and things like that. But I don't remember the kind of the plot of the film. But I do remember going to see it and it being an experience for sure.
Would you say that is the movie that made you fall in love with movies? Or is there something else that sort of catalyzed that conversation?
I have a very weird relationship with movies as a child because my parents, they were, you know, they're Vietnamese war refugees. They owned a small business. They would come home late from work around like 8 p.m. each night. And they took me to see films with them. But it wasn't the films you imagine a family going to see. I remember going to see movies like Basic Instinct or Indecent Proposal and, you know, Rising Sun.
I feel like this is very Kate Hagen, honestly.
Do you have the same experience, Kate?
Yeah, I watched a lot of stuff way before when I should have. Mine was like illicit watching on my own, though. It was not parent sanctioned. Okay. But yeah, seeing Basic Instinct at 9 is quite a journey.
Yeah, I think seeing it with your parents too, I think, you know, just the idea of like seeing anything that has as that's a little sexual with your parents, but something that sexual. And they would make me cover my eyes basically the whole film. It's like, why am I even here if I'm just covering my eyes the whole time? You know, that was an entry point into movies and, you know, the films that I wanted to see. I remember finally going to see Home Alone. It was my birthday, my sister and my cousin. At first, I wanted to see this film called The Rescuers. It's like some Disney movie, like with
the Rescuers
mice.
Go Down Under.
That one, yeah. Exactly. You guys are the experts. So I wanted to go see that. And my cousin and my sister are like, no, we're going to see Home Alone, even though it's my birthday. But I remember just being blown away by watching the first Home Alone as a kid and just laughing so hard and just having that communal experience of cinema that I think can't be replicated in any other type of circumstance, even when you're watching something on television with a big group of people. Another moment I remember in terms of just thinking about cinema and watching something communally is when I was going to Vietnam for the first time in my life. This is 1992. I was nine. Nine was a really formative year for me, apparently.
It was a big year for you, yeah.
And it was my parents' first time going back to Vietnam after they had left in 1979. So it's a really emotional journey for them because they were seeing their family for the first time in over a decade. It was my first time meeting my grandparents, my family. I have like 70 cousins, so it's pretty intense. But I remember going to my dad's village. He lived in a small village in Guangxi, which is right below the 17th parallel. So there's a lot of fighting there. The first night we were there, my uncle had a small black and white television, and he put it out in kind of the family courtyard. My dad lived on a farm, and in the courtyard, he set up this TV. I had no idea what we were watching, but the entire village came to watch what was ever on television, no matter what was on. And it was just this amazing bonding experience because it was something that felt like universal. It wasn't something like, I didn't feel like I was in Vietnam. I didn't feel like I was in America. I felt like I was watching something with a group of human beings, and just like seeing that flickering light from a black and white television was something like magical to me. And so that's always stuck in my mind in terms of just like watching something in a group.
It's really interesting. You know, we've been doing a number of these interviews, and one of the things that keeps coming up, and it's sort of remarkable how consistent it is the extent to which people's parents were responsible for their falling in love with movies, right? Like so many of the filmmakers, especially that we've talked to, have said some version of, my parents were really into film. And that's been especially true, oddly enough, of the people we've interviewed whose parents have been immigrants. I can't quite figure out why that might be, but I'm just curious, like, would you know where your parents got their love of movies, right? Like, we don't really think of, like, a part of the Vietnamese refugee experience as, like, taking your kid to watch Basic Instinct at nine. You're not the first person who's mentioned some version of that, which is remarkable.
I don't know if my parents, like, love movies. I know my dad has this weird kind of love-hate relationship. He would usually, as I grew older, he would never want to watch a movie that wasn't based on a true story or wasn't a documentary. He had this like kind of, I don't know what it was, pushback against things that were not true.
Like hated fiction.
Yeah. I mean, he would never let me read fiction. I literally had to read the encyclopedia. That's what the thing that they made me read when I was a kid from like start to finish was encyclopedia. My mom, on the other hand, would watch cartoons with me. She was open to watching a lot of different things. So that was a great bonding experience with my mom. She still loves watching cartoons with me, which is really cute. But yeah, you know, like Basic Instinct, A Distant Proposal, like Sliver. I don't think they took me or wanted to watch those movies because they love movies. I think they maybe love something else. I don't want to call them out necessarily.
It's an awkward thing to think about your parents in retrospect.
Yeah.
You're
oh,
right. That was what was going on in those years of my life.
There is a movie that they took me to that really was formative called Heaven and Earth, Oliver Stone's film, right? About the Vietnam War, about this, it's based on a memoir of a Vietnamese woman who's a refugee and comes over to America. And that was intense for me because I think I was 10 when I saw that film. There was a very explicit depiction of a rape. It was the first time I'd really seen something so graphic, and I understood that. Like, it was a kind of sexual awakening for me in many ways. It's like, this is what sex is. It's like something that's very violent and primal. But I saw my parents connect to the story so much. Like, I didn't, when I was watching like Basic Instinct, obviously there wasn't that same connection, but they were very emotional watching that film. And I was emotional because I was seeing my parents' story on screen, on this massive silver screen. There was a lot of trauma, obviously, of being Vietnamese war refugees. So I never asked them that story of like how they came over until last year. I did a short documentary, and I think it might have been that moment where I saw them watching that film, where I saw them be emotional for the first time, because they were never emotional to me as my parents. I think since then, I never asked that story because I saw that reaction from them. And that was, again, that was another film that taught me like the power of representation, the power of like telling our own stories and seeing ourselves on screen.
Would you consider that Heaven and Earth to be the first time you kind of saw yourself on screen, that you felt like represented by a character? That doesn't have to be the answer either, but that's actually a great segue into our next question, in which we ask about the first character that you kind of recognized and said, oh, damn, that's me.
I think, the story as a whole, I don't think there was any particular character in that film other than the lead female character. I recognize my mom in that character, and I recognize their story, like kind of going to America and going to a grocery store. There's like this epic scene where she's wearing like this Vietnamese like traditional dress, like blue dress, and she's walking through these huge aisles shot like super wide angle where she's basically engulfed by like American consumerism in a way. That just had some resonance towards me. In terms of like seeing myself on screen, it's not the most positive portrayal, but I remember like Short Round and Indiana Jones, because he was kind of my age. I mean, the person who plays him is Vietnamese. The character's not Vietnamese in the film, but it was just like this idea of the sidekick, right? The idea of kind of heavily accented, but someone who looked like me, but didn't sound like me or act like me in any way. So he was very much a kind of exotic foreigner, but it was seeing someone who was like me. I mean, later on, obviously watching like Enter the Dragon, I saw Enter the Dragon when I was still a young boy, like Saturday afternoon syndication television, right? And that empowered me because it was the first time I actually saw a hero, a leading man that sort of looked like me. I can't claim that I look like Bruce Lee, right? But there was a connection there for sure. And that's always remained in my heart, just Bruce Lee being a symbol of representation as a hero, especially for the Asian American community.
Who do you think, sort of as an adult now, looking back on like everything you've ever watched, like who's the film character you most identify with now?
Who?
It's a tough one. We can come back to that. But it's always a fun question because it's like, I mean, I'm black. Like, I've had my own experiences with that where you're like, I kind of identify with this character, but like, is this all I have to choose from? And then you get exposed to more and you're like, okay, thank God there's more of this. In fairness, I also desperately wanted to be Bruce Lee after I saw Enter the Dragon. And I think that was true of literally everybody.
Yeah.
So
let me get back to you on that one. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
We're going to talk about Be Water in just a minute, which is Bao's fantastic documentary about Bruce Lee. But before we get there, you know, we're kind of talking around conversation around representation and particularly depictions of Asian characters in media. So I wanted to back up a bit before we got to Be Water to talk about your 2015 documentary, Live from New York, which is all about detailing the inner workings of Saturday Night Live. Last fall, Bowen Yang became the first ever Asian cast member on the show, which has also included in its history things like yellow face depictions of Asian characters, a lot of Asian stereotypes, and a lot more that has sort of informed what comedy looks like in America for the last 50 years. So I'm wondering, as a documentarian, how do you sort of approach an exploration of something like Saturday Night Live that has such a complicated history, particularly as it relates to representation of not only Asian cast members and Asian characters on the show, but kind of across the diversity spectrum?
For me, all my film projects, even if I'm not connected to it on a personal level, I try to find that personal connection, that touch point, just so that film feels like it's my film, that you feel my voice in it. And with Saturday Night Live, I was approached with that project around its 39th anniversary, because they wanted something to come out during the 40th anniversary. And I wasn't like one of those fans. I was born like in the mid 80s, so I wasn't watching when it first came out. And I was thinking, like, when I first watched SNL, and it was probably like the Sandler Farley years. And I remember watching it because my parents, they would only let me watch the news, like the 11 p.m. news. And that was my entry point into America, like late 80s, early 90s America is like the news. It's like, America's pretty like, you know, scary.
The Persian Gulf War and like super predators and things
LA
like that.
LA riots. And I was like, okay. But, you know, Saturday night was kind of this anomaly because I could stay up later. Usually during the weeknights, I would have to go to bed right after the newscast. And Saturday night, I would stay up and I would watch SNL, and it became kind of my education into America in a lighter form, right? Instead of the news, it taught me about American political culture, taught me about social culture, definitely taught me about celebrity and pop culture in a way that my parents as Vietnamese refugees, as immigrants, were never going to be able to teach me. And so that was the way I wanted to approach Live from New York as well. It's like, I mean, how is SNL this entry point into events, into culture, and how has it impacted it? Obviously, during an election year, it's much more impactful, but there are these different parts of American history that kind of reflect back and mirror back SNL and vice versa. And I think we do touch upon race in the documentary. And one of the people who I really fell in love with while making the film, his name is Akira. He's one of the production designers who has been working on the show for like since the beginning. And they basically had him play like Zulu on like every Star Trek parody, right? And he just didn't do, I mean, if you watch those episodes, it's so deadpan and so hilarious what he does, because he's just a production designer. And they couldn't get like, there's no Asian talent or representation on that show, except for the production designer at the time. And so when like Bowen got the job, it was just like something that for our community definitely felt like it was past due, but we're all pushing for Bowen, who's hilarious, to keep going. And just, you know, it's hard for me. I have a love-hate relationship with a lot of American institutions, but I was like bored into them and I have nothing else to kind of hold on to. And it's also like, I've been asked this question while promoting Be Waters, like, when did you have that point where you felt Asian American? And I grew up in a really kind of diverse city. I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, right outside DC. And it was pretty equal in terms of like my friends who were, you know, African American, Asian American, Asian immigrants coming, recent Asian immigrants. And it never like crossed my mind like that identity of Asian American till maybe college when I took like courses in Asian American studies and things like that. So that's always been this like battle for me to like, when do I swing between the Asian American, the American, the Asian? I like to tell this funny story. Whenever like I'm in Paris or like Europe or like a very Eurocentric city, they're always like, "Wow, you're like so American." And I was like, "Oh my God, you don't know how much that means to me." Like, even though they're saying it in a very derogatory way, I'm just like, this is like my identity crisis. Like, I never felt belonging in any culture.
It's like an insult, and you're just like, "Thank you so much like, for saying that."
It's like, finally, you see me, Parisian.
I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, whatever happens with Bowen on SNL, I think he's going to be fine because he is hilarious. And Bowen, if you want to come on the show, we're right here. Anyway, moving on. Kate, sorry.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
We were just touching on you being a boy and seeing Enter the Dragon for the first time and that being a really formative experience. But, you know, when we talk about Bruce Lee, it's sort of difficult to talk about him as a real person because he has taken on such mythic proportions since his death. He's been so discussed, so analyzed. So I'm wondering what drew you specifically to tell this story about Bruce Lee, which is a much more grounded, humanist take on who he was. was and the people that loved him and the people that he loved. I'm just kind of curious what attracted you to tell this story of Bruce Lee this way.
I mean, as we were talking earlier, Bruce Lee became sort of the symbol of representation of Asian American masculinity to me in many ways. But I felt like I didn't know anything about him. I knew the myth of Bruce Lee, the icon Bruce Lee, but I wanted to unpack that myth. I think we can only really aspire to be like our heroes if we can connect to them, we can understand their struggles, their fears, their vulnerabilities. That was one of the main approaches of the film, talking to the people who knew him, because I think everyone has their touch point of Bruce Lee. And trying to cover all those touch points would be a daunting task. And one of the great things that I've been able to see, as, you know, the film has aired on ESPN, is like how many people, how many families have been watching it multi-generationally? Like the grandfather, you know, father, daughter, they all watched the film together. And I think that's such a beautiful thing. And it makes me not want to make like esoteric dark films anymore, because I want to make films that the whole family can watch. And they all had their different touch points into Bruce Lee. Like, you know, the grandfather watched Green Hornet, and then the son watched Enter the Dragon, and then the daughter like listened to like LL Cool J, or like, I'm trying to think of a cooler Bruce Lee reference recently.
Well, I actually think that every generation has had some exposure to Enter the Dragon, but that's, I'm probably biased because that is exactly the touch point I think that my generation had. Like, Enter the Dragon was a seminal movie watching experience for me. It was just like, oh my God, what is this? And where can I find more of it? But I also know that my dad had a similar experience with that movie, right? And I know my younger brother did, and I'm betting my nieces did or have already.
I mean, it's surprising that like a lot of people were like, oh, I didn't know anything about Bruce Lee and I've never seen his films. Now I'm going to watch his films after this. And I mean, this is a really funny story where we were doing post-production in London. And towards the end of our edit, you know, there was a receptionist, person of color, young, in her early 20s. She's like, oh, you know, you've been coming here for a few weeks. What are you working on? I was like, oh, we're making a film about Bruce Lee. And she's like, oh, the Kung Fu guy. I was like, yeah. And she's like, oh, is he going to come in and watch the film? And that kind of opened my mind up. It's like, this is why, this is a reason this film is important. There's some people who are like, oh, there's so many Bruce Lee documentaries. And I definitely encourage people to watch those documentaries. But they're, I think we are kind of like reshaping mythology for each generation sometimes when we're retelling stories, especially Bruce Lee's story. Because again, there's so many touch points. Obviously, I mean, I don't want, honestly, and this is no like shade to like Tarantino, but I don't want that to be the lasting memory of this generation of Bruce Lee and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Well, we can talk about that later.
I mean, look, but it's really interesting. Like, I think of myself as an actual Bruce Lee fan, right? And in watching your doc, there were so many things that I just didn't realize, whether it's the child actor thing or like his connection. Like, my favorite moment in the entire doc, by the way, and it almost feels like a throwaway, is when he's asked about the fact that he has a bunch of gems in San Francisco and he's like, Oakland, which is like, everyone I know from Oakland, that is how they behave. And the fact that like Bruce Lee did that like Oakland quirk thing was hilarious to me. But this notion of him as like a highly ambitious striver on some level who didn't just walk into Hollywood as an already godlike figure, which is what I think I just assumed, was really radical to me. And I'm just curious like how you approached even researching the human side of a god.
Yeah, I kind of like took two approaches to the film. The coming of age of Bruce Lee, which is like unpacking the myth, and then the coming of history of the Asian American. Because for me, it's like, okay, Bruce Lee got rejected by Hollywood. What was the history? What was the reckoning that happened before of the Asian American, the stereotypes, the xenophobic policies that would make someone say no to, as you say, Franklin, I'm quoting you, a god like Bruce Lee. And you wonder, and you have to...
Yeah, for the record, I'll stand by that.
Okay.
Like, yeah, we're good.
And yeah, I wanted people to know that Bruce Lee was Asian American. He always wanted to be seen as something, a human being, as he says in his famous quote, right? He doesn't want to be seen as Chinese, as North American. He wants to be seen as a human being. But people at that time did not see him as a human being. And that's important to note. And even now, people don't see him as Asian American. In a way, he's transcended his race. He's been successful in spite of his race. He's a global cultural icon. He's not an Asian American icon to many people. And as an Asian American, I was like, this is my chance to kind of own Bruce Lee for, who he is, who he grew up as, his identity that so many people used against him. And so it meant going back to like the Chinese railroad workers, to the Chinese Exclusion Act, to Yellow Peril, to the model minority myth, because all of these different aspects of how we approach a race, a nationality, ethnicity, either through government institutions with laws or policy, or how we deal with it through like kind of xenophobic and racism, implicit bias, was important to understand like why Bruce Lee couldn't be the lead of the show, right? Because you have to understand like why are Asian males emasculated on screen? Why are they seen as the sidekick? Why can they never be the hero? Why can they never be the leading man? And it starts with all these moments in history where they're being told and disenfranchised and marginalized. And so, yeah, those two ideas guided me in the making of the film. And to kind of do a coming of age, you have to talk to the people who knew him the best. So we went to all the cities that he lived in, Oakland, Hong Kong, LA, Seattle, and we talked to the people who knew him the best. And I didn't want to talk to people who speaks of him in the past or speaks of him as a person who impacted their life, but they don't know anything about him as a person. They didn't talk to him. They didn't, you know, have dinner with him. They didn't have those conversations. You can ask anyone that, you know, those stories will live on forever, but the people who can talk about him in an intimate way, sadly, they're getting older and we kind of have to collect that history. And so like one of the people I love talking to the most was Amy Sandbo, who is Bruce Lee's first girlfriend in America. And her story is not told in kind of the narrative of Bruce Lee very often. She's only done one print interview 30 years ago, and that's it. And so she told me about how, you know, she's Japanese American. She was in the internment camps during World War II. And she taught Bruce the power of the Asian American identity, which I think was really important, formative for him in the first couple of years he was in America, because I think he either saw it as I'm Asian or I'm going to try to assimilate to become American. And she taught him, no, you can be Asian American. And what does that mean to be Asian American? I think that is something that we all struggle with as immigrant Americans, as being seen as the other. And I wanted Bruce to be seen as the other. I didn't want Bruce to be seen as the dragon, as the god, as the myth, because he didn't start out that way.
Right.
That's really instructive knowing that that's sort of your thematic approach to the documentary, because I was so struck by not just the amount of archival footage and material that the documentary gets through, but what specifically has been pulled. I mean, there are so many incredible behind the scenes clips, photos I had never seen before of Bruce Lee, certainly. I was curious, it's kind of a two-pronged question. What was the approach for sort of deciding what went into the documentary from those archival materials and what unfortunately had to get cut? And the flip of that is we also see no sort of talking heads in this documentary until the very end, when we're sort of introduced to everybody who we've been hearing from throughout the documentary. So I'm curious, what motivated both of those decisions in constructing the documentary?
I can kind of answer both questions in one answer in a way, because I always wanted to be in Bruce's present time. I didn't want to be, again, having someone talk about Bruce in the past, or cutting to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in, you know, his 80s and talking about a 20-year-old Bruce Lee, because that just, there's a bit...
That's weird.
It's jarring, right?
Yeah.
And I love being immersed in a world. That's what I think, for me as a fan of cinema, like I love just feeling like I'm there and I'm feeling like I'm in Bruce's present moment. I'm in the 1950s Hong Kong. I'm in 1960s America. I'm in 1970, back to 1970s Hong Kong. You know, later on, we see, as you said, the idea of seeing the people at the end of the film, Kate, and how you see Linda, who's now 80, you see Kareem, who's, you know, in his 80s, and you see them hold up photos with Bruce Lee in his 20s or his 30s. And then for me, it's like, what would Bruce Lee look like now, if he was a contemporary of Kareem, of Linda? And I think there's like a sense of poignancy there. So that was one of the main reasons for kind of like not showing the interviews till the very end. And I think in terms of archival, it was also just building that immersive experience, building that world of Bruce's time, Bruce's present. Thank you for saying like there's like a lot of like never before seen footage. But like for like hardcore Bruce Lee fan who's literally been like going to yard sales for the last 40 years, every weekend, which I've met some of them, they're like, I've seen every single piece, like frame. And so I knew I wasn't going to satisfy those type of fans in terms of like the visual archive. But I wanted the stories to feel new and fresh and in the moment. That's why talking to Amy Sanbo, you know, talking to Kareem, talking to Bruce's brother, Robert, who doesn't talk so much about Bruce Lee anymore, and hearing those stories of like Bruce's vulnerabilities, like, you know, I think it's kind of cute. Like Amy talks about breaking Bruce's heart and that Bruce kind of like assessed his ambition after that. We all can connect to heartbreak and kind of like finding a new direction in life, but you don't imagine Bruce Lee doing it, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. You don't think of Bruce as like, can't get over this relationship. I need to change my entire life.
That's why I'm going to be teaching kung fu to people.
Exactly.
Like, because if you think about it, like, I would imagine Bruce might have just been living. Amy lives in Arizona now. Can you imagine it's Bruce having a ranch in Arizona, living the domestic life and not? There's so many hypotheticals of his life that could have happened. But yeah, I mean, the archival was really fun because we would go to all these cities and talk to those people. And it wasn't just like going to like stock footage houses or like archive collections, but I was like, when we come to interview, I want you to go in your attic and just find and dust off everything you can find. Even if Bruce isn't in the photo, I want to kind of see you in that time. So we're in that same time where we're kind of like Bruce's POV in a way. And one thing that some people don't notice is that a lot of the footage that we shot a lot of this archival footage, you know, explain. Some things in order, you know, there's a cinematic language to Super 8, right, to 16.
Right.
And there's not that much footage of Bruce Lee because in Hong Kong's a really dense city. So there's not lots of places to store things.
Not a lot of storage.
Yeah, so we would go to there's like this one big television station that owns most of the interviews from the 60s. And they're like, oh yeah, we shot a lot of interviews, but we just taped over all the Bruce Lee interviews because we just didn't have, you know, we didn't have storage to store extra tapes. And I was like, oh my God. And so we went, my DP and I went to Hong Kong and we shot on the roof. The beautiful thing about Hong Kong is you still have that texture of the 1960s there for people who've been there. And so we went to the neighborhoods that Bruce lived in, went to the rooftops that he fought on, and we shot Super 8 on these places. It was, for me, again, it's like trying to make sure the cinematic language is fluid throughout the film, where we don't jump to an HD modern day interview shot. We're always like seeing this grain. Even when we like show a photo, I made sure like, let's add some grain to that. So it always feels like there's fluidity and there's motion and there's texture, because we're making film, we're making motion pictures here. And so we, as much as we can, like feel like we're in it as an audience.
There is a real sense of poignancy in the doc, but it also sort of never verges into, I think we've all seen these sort of congratulatory documentaries that are uninterested in thinking about the person they're depicting critically or sort of showing the complete picture. But I also thought it was a really smart choice throughout this documentary that you decided that you didn't really have an interest in sort of solving Bruce Lee's death, which much of the media that has come since he has passed on has sort of dived into. And unfortunately, you know, that quote unquote myth around Bruce Lee has sort of expanded with the untimely and tragic passing of Brandon Lee while making The Crow 2. But I'm wondering, you know, given that and given the sort of complex legacies of both men and their really tragic deaths, what do you hope that viewers take away from Be Water, not only about the legacy of Bruce Lee, but of Brandon Lee? And what kind of lessons can they take from them into their own lives?
The reason why I didn't kind of delve into the death more, I think that's really important because I wanted to be on an emotional journey. As when you're watching a film, it's not the best films for me. The best documentaries take me on an emotional journey. And I think of films like Amy or like Senna, you know, Asif Kapadia's films, where I don't know anything about this person, but when they die, I am just floored. And like with Bruce Lee, I think sometimes, oh, okay. And then he died. And then why did he, all these things tell me like why he died. And then you kind of lose the emotion of like, this man died before he realized his dream that he was fighting for. And I wanted to just make it matter of fact that, okay, this is the coroner's report. He died. But everyone around him, when I asked him that question, like his friends, his family, they're like, you know, we didn't think about that because we were at such a loss emotionally. And I was like, I want to feel that. I want to feel connected to Bruce Lee as a person and not as like a fan who wants to know why he died. And I guess that kind of answers the larger question, too. It's like, I don't want to see Bruce Lee anymore as an icon. I wanted to see him as a man, as a person, as a human being. And that was what I wanted people to take away with the film, is that even though people people view him as this icon, as this myth, as this legend. He was a person, and he faced a lot of prejudice, systemic racism, things that still exist today. And how did he overcome that? How did Bruce become Bruce Lee? And it's kind of being in the face of all these systems of oppression, of racism, of people telling him he can't do something that made him more than he was as a human being in many ways and immortalized him and became, you know, this hero for the marginalized community, for the African-American community, which I don't think he could have ever fathomed in his death. But it just shows like the power of like, I think films and like the ability of film to create mythology. And like Asian-Americans, we don't have our myths. You know, there's deep roots of Asian mythology, but not Asian American mythology. And Bruce Lee is our Asian American myth, right? And for me, that's what he taught me. He wanted to build more mythology. He wanted to be the leading man. He wanted to be the romantic lead in a film. He wants to make the Asian myth be multifaceted, not just the martial arts hero, which it's become because of his death. I think I can speak specifically for my community as Asian Americans working in the industry, and they've been so supportive of this film and just like pushing it out and just feeling like they've been seen and like they didn't know the struggle because they relate to the struggle so much today. And they're like, Bruce Lee had these same kind of like, again, it's just about humanizing right. Someone like Bruce Lee. It's like humanizing Jesus and in some ways, right?
I mean, look, the man died at 32. The comparisons are not completely insane.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Insane. But I'm curious, look, I also think that we're in this moment, it's always dangerous to talk about sort of like a new wave of like Asian American cinema, but like when I look around the industry, I mean, frankly, at some of my friends who are just like crushing it, there does seem to be a new wave of Asian American filmmakers who are getting their due, right? And there are stories that are sort of being put on Front Street and they're being enjoyed not just by the Asian American community, but by sort of all American audiences and really audiences around the world. And that, you know, fortunately runs against the depictions of Bruce in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and some of these depictions that have sort of been forerunners of all of this. I'm just kind of curious how that feels in this moment and what you sort of hope for going forward.
I feel very empowered, to be honest. I feel like the community, one of the reasons that Bruce wasn't able to kind of get past the systemic racism and, you know, of Hollywood was that he was kind of all alone in that world as an Asian American. Not to say that there weren't people like Cherche K and many other. I think it was hard enough to kind of galvanize as a community. I see that as being a huge difference now, that there is a community that are supporting each other. And there are people not just in front of the camera, but behind the camera. And I just like look at the people that you've had on the show recently, like Alan Yang and Alice, and they're like making it, they're writing, they're directing. Yeah. And that's really just, I come from a documentary background, but I'm getting into scripted. And I think seeing kind of the people who I've stood on the shoulders of, like Bruce, and then all these other filmmakers like Justin and like Lulu and everyone that's really inspiring, it makes me empowered. And to be honest, I didn't know if I wanted to bring this up, but like I watched The Five Bloods over the weekend and I found a lot of the Vietnamese depictions problematic. I had a lot of friends who worked on that film. I was there when they were shooting in Vietnam. And it just taught me, like, if I want my story seen in Hollywood, I'm going to have to make it my damn self, which is fine.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you, by the way. Does that make you want to make your sort of Vietnam scripted movie?
You mean like my Vietnam War scripted movie? Or?
Well, yeah. But like, yes, your Vietnam War scripted movie. Fair correction. Like, does having that experience make you say, you know what? All right, I got to go write this thing now. Or does it make you say, you know what? I don't even want to do, like, how does that feel? And like, what is it? How do you respond?
Yeah, I think totally. I mean, it goes back to the idea of mythology and myth building, because the myth of the American War has grossly left out the Vietnamese story, right? And I think until that is corrected in some way, or at least had some one film that I can say, okay, if you want to learn about the Vietnam, there's like literally like no films.
Well, it's ironic, right? Because like Spike was sort of making the Five Bloods as the like, this is like the Black American story hadn't been told, which you should. But you, and then you're like, yeah, but there's this whole other side of the experience that's still untold, and I'm gonna have to do that now myself.
That's why I think it's always important for different generations to keep on reshaping these myths, these narratives. It's like, oh, there's so many Bruce Lee documentaries. Like, well, it's gonna keep on coming when you have someone like as mythical as Bruce Lee, the same with the Vietnam War. It's all these touch points. And I don't think there's anything as such thing as a like definitive film about any one subject. And we should keep on telling multiple stories. Like, again, like this idea of the danger of the single story, right? And we should, as people who have the privilege to make mythology, I don't want to sound self-important here working in the industry, but being stuck at home for 3 months, my interaction with society is what I see on TV, what I'm watching on film. And I'm sure that's most people's idea of society. And so we have a responsibility and privilege to make a multifaceted version of that. And not to go on kind of a tangent here, but yeah, I mean, I appreciated kind of learning about the Black vet experience through the Five Bloods. And it's something that I didn't know so much about. And I think, again, it's adding to this idea of what the Vietnam War is, but it empowers me for sure to tell that side of the Vietnam War. Because as I was saying earlier, it's like, we haven't formed that mythology on our side. And I actually work in Vietnam a lot, in the Vietnamese film industry. And when I pitch like a Vietnam War project to like local producers, they're like, oh, we won the war. We don't care about it anymore. And, you know, that's not really shown in Spike's film. But like, and the younger generation that are making films, they don't care about it either. I live, again, in this privileged position where my existence is due to like my parents like leaving Vietnam because of the war. So I want to make sure that story sets straight. But I also think that in terms of like the next step for representation, there's this Vietnamese American poet Ocean Vuong who talks about this idea of like people of color, artists of color are always expected to make memoir because we're like, we're supposed to be like the tour guides for like a mainstream culture into our trauma, into our world, but we're not allowed to be world builders. We're not entrusted yet to be artisans and craftspeople of building a new world. And I think that's the next step that I would love to take with everyone who feels like they haven't had a chance to kind of build their own world cinematically. But I still want to make that kind of Vietnam War film that I feel can speak to my generation, to someone who looks like me.
So we're going to pivot towards the end here and do a sort of speed round of questions. And Kate and I will just sort of go back and forth, and I'll let Kate start.
So we're going to kick it off with a fun one, which is, what is a movie that is generally agreed upon to be terrible that you love and will defend forever?
Okay. It's a Michael Bay film, but I think it's Michael Bay's best film. And I'm sure some people would say it's amazing.
The answer better be The Rock.
It is The Rock. It is The Rock.
Okay, okay. I was going to say, that is Michael Bay's best film. I agree. I'm not certain that counts as a movie that everyone agrees is terrible, but we'll give it to you.
You give it to me? Okay.
Well, if only because we're short on time. Okay. Single movie moment, shot, scene, cut, ending beat, whatever, that stayed with you the longest or that you expect to stay with you the longest.
I feel like one scene that just off the top of my head is the opening sequence of Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, the cooking scene.
Ooh, that's a really good one. Yeah.
Yeah. Now that I like watch other food porn films and then I see that film, it's like, you don't need like a slow motion close up of like something. Like just hear the sounds of like oil frying and like herbs being cut. It's just like so visceral.
We love a cooking movie here on this podcast.
We do love a cooking movie.
What movie do you find yourself recommending to friends most often?
There's this film called Alan the Sparrow. It was made 2008, 2007. It's by a dear friend of mine who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. And it came out like the same year as like Slumdog Millionaire. And it's about like three people in Saigon who converge, and they're all from different aspects of life in Saigon. And it's just this beautiful kind of like urban fairy tale. And it just shows Saigon for all its kind of energy, complexity, and in some ways, simplicity. I think there's like, I've worked on a film that was like a Vietnamese science fiction film. And we had an audience member like, why didn't you talk about Agent Orange in this film? I was like, it's a science fiction film. And so like, I like the simplicity of this film, Out in the Sparrow, by this director named Stefan Galger. So I highly recommend, if you want to see a multifaceted version of the Vietnam experience, of like modern Vietnam experience, I highly recommend that film.
Right on. So this is a two-parter. So I used to work for Sidney Pollack, and Sidney Pollack used to say that he was only interested in making movies about two subjects, and they were war and love, because they were the only two things that in humanity we were no closer to understanding now than we were thousands of years ago, which beget this question, which is, what is your favorite movie about love, and what is your favorite movie about war?
Ooh, I would say in terms of like war, I mean, Heaven and Earth just had such a deeply profound effect on me. I felt like it was the closest thing to showing the Vietnamese side of the war through this young woman and her struggles and her kind of journey to America. And also because of the personal connection that I mentioned earlier. And in terms of love, I'm like a hopeless romantic, so I should know this better. I think in terms of like idealized romantic love that is not representative of realistic love, and this is very cinematic love, and maybe this is, we're talking about cinematic love.
Caveat appreciated.
Yeah. I mean,
but what's the movie?
In the Mood for Love by Wong Kar-wai. I think
I think that's actually, Kate, was that my answer too?
It's hard to argue with. Like, it's just, that's one of the best answers you can give for that question.
I don't want to sound cliche. Are you saying I sound cliche? Or that's
you
just
do not
a universe?
No, it's just like, it's one of those things, like, what's one of the greatest movies about war? Doctor Strangelove. Like, it just is what it is. Like, it's one of the best. It's not,
I mean, I've literally gone to Wong Kar, Angkor Wat, and whispered secrets into the temple. So
That's some really good juju. I like that as a like film tour location.
I will do that when I go to Angkor Wat. I've never been, but believe me, I will inevitably do it. All right, last question, Kate, take us home.
So we like to close every conversation the same way, which is by asking, if you could hold a worldwide screening for every person on planet Earth of one movie, what movie would you choose?
Bicycle Thieves, the Italian neorealist film. I just think like that I want to just like see everyone's face at the end when he's, spoiler alert, you know, the father steals the bike and you see the little boy's reaction and just like, oh God, this is cinema.
Perfect. We're done. That was great.
Bao, thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
Thank you all so much.
From Luminary, The Blacklist Podcast is a production of The Blacklist and Ninth Planet Audio. Our executive producers are Franklin Leonard, Kate Hagen, Han Zani, and Jimmy Miller. Gabrielle Horton is our lead producer. Nicholas Pertel composed our theme music, and this episode was edited and mixed by Kevin Liu. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at ThatHagenGirl, ThatHagenGrrl. You can find Franklin on Twitter at Franklin Leonard and on Instagram at Franklin J. Leonard. And you can find The Blacklist on both Twitter and Instagram at The Blacklist, ThebLcklst.